Contamination of our environment by man-made and naturally occurring pollutants and toxins is well known. But what impact has this on the health of our most vulnerable population, our children? Well, joining me this morning to explore this very expansive subject is Brooks Gump, Associate Professor in Syracuse University's Department of Public Health, Food Studies, and Nutrition. Welcome, Dr. Gump.
Thank you.
Well, you know, this is a very scary topic, actually. I mean, I'm a parent, although my children are now grown. And we've heard for many years, you know, that there are all of these new toxins in a way, old and new toxins in our environment. So what are we talking about when we use that term, pollutants and toxins?
Well, there's a host of chemicals. Some are man-made, some are not. So certainly like lead, mercury are not, but they've been used in industry, so they've been distributed and redistributed in the environment so that we're more exposed to them. And then there's some of the newer ones, the dioxins, DDT, and perfluoric chemicals, which are used in things like Gore-Tex. Those are newer, and those are now being widely dispersed as well in consumer products, and then they get in the environment.
Now, on a global scale, I know that you know, there have been traditional environmental hazards, like we know that you can have contaminated water. I mean, many places don't in the world don't even have clean water, or they could have poor sanitation, or they have, you know, I know in China, all of this biomass burning of coal and things, the air gets polluted. And clearly, there are very serious other things like malaria worldwide. I mean, those are serious, effects, toxins for our health overall. But what you're talking about, the ones that you're talking about, really are a result largely of what we're doing to the environment.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes.
I mean, even more so.
Yes, yes. And then there's different, the governments have different ideas about what is important. So, for instance, in China, the level of concern for lead is twice as much as it is in the United States.
Why is that?
Because as you start to lower those levels, it starts to put more pressure politically. You know, you double the number, you dramatically increase the number of your population that is at a level of concern. So.
Well, I'm not clear. Help me with that. When you say when you lower the level of lead in the environment,
You don't actually lower the level. You lower what we call like the threshold.
So I see. You're saying that they don't pay attention if it's right below a certain level.
Correct.
More people are affected.
Right. So in China, it's 20 micrograms per deciliter. In the United States, it's 10, and there's calls to move it down even further. But once you start doing that, then it kicks in all the regulatory, or should at least kick in regulatory measures to try to adjust it. So there's a lot of political and scientific exchange there.
And clearly what that speaks to, the bottom line, is what the governments are willing to spend.
Correct.
To either correct the problem or change the way that they do business.
Right. It's a cost-benefit ratio that you have to look at, whether there's a lot that they, you know, whether they can do a lot, and how much it costs to do that.
So a lot of whether we address these issues has to do both, of course, with the economic forces that drive them to begin with, but also then the political will, I would think, to make a change.
Right, correct. Yeah, but I think it's, you know, really what we, as scientists, and being a scientist, what we need to do is really determine what the effects are and what the long-term effects are in order to give that kind of, potentially give that political clout, as you say, to make those changes. But on the other hand, you know, if the effects aren't very strong, and there certainly could be chemicals that really aren't doing very much to us, then we, you know, wouldn't spend as much money to alleviate those.
So the bottom line is, the scientists really have to come up with some answers
right
as to which of these chemicals are hazardous.
Correct. And I think the government needs to invest the money to find that, to do that, conduct that research.
Right. So it was my understanding that a lot of the long-term consequences of these more modern toxic threats to our air and our water and all of that, and our soil even, are not really well understood at this point.
Right. They aren't. For example, PFCs, the perfluoric chemicals, and Stainmaster, Gore-Tex, those have been around for 20 years. And just now, they're starting to do some studies on potential and looking, you know, potential effects on things like ADD and impulsivity in children. So, my perspective on that is that that kind of research should have probably preceded the exposure to the toxicants. But it works the other way around. And then at that point, it starts to bioaccumulate, and you get it in fish. And then getting it out of the system takes 20, 30 years.
You know, you mentioned DDT, which struck me as an interesting point, because I can remember when it was probably in the 60s, maybe, or even before, that there was clearly, or maybe the 60s, probably, you'd know better.
That's not my, DDT isn't one I've done research
right,
on.
Right, no, I know, but I remember there being a huge, you know, uproar about DDT and then a banning of using DDT right. at some point. So there has been some history there
yes.
of people recognizing the hazard. So yep. it's still being used, is that correct?
PFCs, they shift them. And so they use different, there's six different types. And
okay.
one they've done away with, but then they've replaced it with other modified PFCs. So, they're still in use. And you know, there's some question about which ones have effects within that. So it's really complicated. But again, yeah, I mean, I think the idea of starting to use these without knowing what they do is not a good idea.
No, and it's really amazing that that takes place on such, well, I shouldn't say, I mean, with money is the driving force rather than the well-being, the public good, so to speak. That's the explanation right there,
right.
it seems to me.
Right.
Well, it sounds like this is a very, very huge undertaking for scientists then, and they need to have the funding to do it.
Right.
And are you finding, we have just a little bit of time left before we take a break, is that funding available to
Well, I mean, NIH has, it's a National Institute of Environmental Health Studies, so it does have a division that has, you know, does fund studies and research. So it's always a question of the priorities of NIH. Where they shift, are they, you know, are we...
And who's in power in the government,
probably. Yeah, probably.
I'm going to ask you to hold that thought because we're going to have to take a short break. But we'll be right back with more from Dr. Gump and right after this break. So please stay right there with us. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with my guest, Dr. Brooks Gump. And we're talking about environmental pollutants and their effect on children's health. So before the break, we were talking about, all of these issues and what causes them and what drives them as far as the, you know, economics of probably manufacturing, I would think, in a lot of cases, mm-hmm. creates a lot of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get back to why are children most vulnerable to this? I would think that everyone is affected to some degree, but why are children...
Well, I mean, there's different ideas. I mean, part of it is their systems are just developing, and so they're, in that sense, there's less resilience to insult on those systems for children. It may be just the fact that, as you said, that we're all affected, and they do have less ability to cope with the effects of those. So you might be exposed to something that increases your, increases your impulsivity, such as PFCs, is what I've been looking at with children, and they're less able to adapt to it. And so maybe other behaviors we're looking at, like risky behaviors, smoking and drinking, may occur as a result of that exposure. Whereas in adults, they may be able to adjust more to that exposure.
So let me understand this, because this is really interesting to me. Clearly, first let's start with, how do children get exposed to these things? I mean, what's the natural chain of events?
No, they're all different depending on the chemical. So for PFCs, and they're largely unknown still as well, but for PFCs, perfluoric chemicals, they're used also to coat fast food wrappers. They're used in the Gore-Tex stain master or Teflon. Microwave popcorn, I think, is another source of PFCs. So the wrapping.
In what way? The wrapping. Yeah. So in other words, by sticking something that's wrapped with PFCs on it into a microwave, it literally migrates into the popcorn and then you ingest it.
I don't know that. That I have a collaborator that does that.
But that's the theory, hypothesis.
Yeah, I don't, yeah. I
mean, it's not proven.
Well, and they're looking at whether it's airborne and what surface it gets on. And I look more after the fact. So we take blood from children and we look at their levels. So I haven't personally done a lot of research on, you know, where in the environment it's coming from. That was one of the grants that we were trying to get funded to look at that. And so that's a, I think that's an open question. I mean, we had reviewers that were concerned that we were going to do our study in Syracuse as opposed to Oswego, which is where I had my initial cohort, because the idea is maybe they're not getting them from those kind of sources. They're getting them from fish, and Oswego, there's a lot of fish consumption. So along with the PCBs, which there's been research on, they're maybe also collecting the PFCs or bioaccumulating those PFCs in the fish.
Okay, before we continue on the kind of mechanism, let's talk about what are the critical threats. Let's just go through what are the chemicals that you're of most are of most concern right now to scientists like yourself.
Well, I mean, you there's so many. So you look at the ones that that have mechanistic potential for having an effect. The three that I've looked at are lead, mercury, and then the PFCs. One of the things with the lead, for example, is that they thought that it was just you get high levels, and they were studying high levels. My research, we're looking at responses to stress in kids that are exposed to levels that are, quote, normal. So I just don't select exposed kids. All my kids have levels that are about 3 micrograms per deciliter or less, which is very, very small amounts.
And that's a random sample of your population.
Right, right. And then within that group, the kids that are maybe between 1.5 and 3 have a higher, stronger stress response in terms of their vasculature relative to 1.5 and lower. So when we stress them out with, like, computer tasks, their vasculature constricts more strongly with just those slightly elevated. So they're not elevated in any other sense. They're, you know, CDC would say they're perfectly fine, but we're finding there is a difference.
So you're saying that even things that don't now be, even levels that are not now seen as hazardous within the general population, you're seeing some effect in behavior.
Correct. Yeah, and they may be hazardous. That's the point.
So that obviously that level of concern will have to change, and
right,
those levels will have to change in accordance with your findings.
Right.
But right now, what it sounds like is you are seeing some changes in behavior or response to the environment.
The response to stress.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the cardiovascular response. And we did echocardiograms on the kids, and there's even some suggestion that their heart, the structure of the heart may be changing slightly. As a function of these slightly elevated levels.
Have any of these studies also been done with adults to see if there's a concomitant effect, or at this point you're just mostly focusing on children?
I've just done children. I don't know the effect. I mean, there's effects on hypertension and things like, but again, those are all for levels that are elevated. We haven't looked, and no labs looked at the effects of stress responses in adults with slightly elevated lead levels.
So lead is pretty much endemic, isn't it? Lead is everywhere.
Yeah.
I know at one point there was a great deal of concern about lead in paint, and then mm-hmm. there was, of course, a ban on using lead paint, and then there was concern about all the children who may be growing up in homes where there was lead, where prior to this ban, lead was in the paint, and it would be chipping and peeling, and babies might eat it,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, inadvertently ingest it, and that kind of, so that they, showing higher levels of lead. Now,
right.
Has that changed significantly in terms of our general environment? In other words, have we done a good job of controlling lead?
It's gotten better, but there's still thousands of homes in Syracuse area that still have lead paint, and they prioritize which ones they deal with. And usually, it's the flag is a child coming in with a level of 20. I believe it's, they have thresholds at which point they have to intervene.
So let me understand that it was clearly documented before, in the past, that some higher levels of lead, and I don't know the level, and it's not crucial that that our listeners know exactly the level, but the point is, at some high level, it did have a deleterious effect on children.
Well, sure.
Learning
and
disabilities,
right,
all kinds of issues.
Yeah.
IQ, right. But you're saying now in your research, you're looking at much, much lower levels, levels that seem to be almost pervasive within the community, even if they don't have lead paint in their
Correct.
Environment, and that still can be having some effect.
That's the possibility, right.
Tell me some of, because I don't want to run out of time, tell me some of the other potential pollutants.
The other one we looked at was mercury. And for mercury, what we found is, again, these are normal, quote, normal levels. We had one child that was eating like three tuna meals a week, and his level was flagged.
Canned tuna.
His level was like 13 micrograms per deciliter, which is a flag for New York State. So we send the results back to his physician. But that was just one child out of 140. that had elevated. Everything else was kind of the normal, eating a few fish meals here and there.
And you found?
And with that, the ones who ate fish had slightly higher levels of mercury, as you would expect, but they also had higher levels of, well, they had lower levels of a stress hormone, cortisol, which is, you think of as good, but cortisol also serves as a to prevent inflammation, inflammatory markers were, so these kids were having less control of their inflammatory response.
Interesting, because it was my understanding that something like cortisol was a negative. You always hear, you know, when people are under in a stress environment, their levels of cortisol go up, and that's bad for them. And you're suggesting that you need cortisol?
It's a diurnal, the diurnal pattern of cortisol is such that it's there's a morning peak, and then it declines over the day, and that's, quote, good. That shows good regulation. If the HPA, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, that part that controls the cortisol, if that's chronically stressed, then ultimately there's an inability for the body to respond in a normal diurnal pattern. So the cortisol is kind of flat over the day.
So so just getting back to your children.
The children with higher levels of mercury had a flat diurnal cortisol pattern. And that was also associated with proteins in their body that would suggest inflammation.
Let me ask you this, though. I understand how you're doing, I mean, your study, and I don't want to go into, we don't have time to go into a whole analysis of your methodology and all of that, but is this more of a correlation, meaning you don't really have a causal proof? You can't say because they had this, they then had this.
No.
You're seeing what we call a correlation. It seems like in these kinds of situations with certain higher levels of something, we also find this. But you're not really 100% sure at this point, or can't be.
No, and we
that one caused the other. Am
right,
I correct?
Right. We're trying to do, and that's important. That's an important step. What we do is we have control variables, so we have a number of things we measure, and we can say it's not those. But you're right. The next step is to either increase the children's mercury by giving them fish, which is, I think, ethical if you'd keep it within the boundaries of what's the American Heart Association's recommendation for fish, because it does have beneficial effects, or you go the reverse and you try to reduce it and see the effects.
Well, basically, tell me very briefly, and also we have dioxins and PCBs. We're running out of time, and I want to get to this. What are the major effects you worry about? Developmental delays?
They're different, all different.
ADHD?
Depends on the toxicant. So for mercury, it would be this inflammation and the effects on immunity.
Even the immune response.
Yeah. And then for lead, it's effects on cardiovascular disease down the line. For PFCs, we're looking at the impulsivity, response inhibition, risky behaviors like alcohol. So I think it really depends on the chemical.
Well, it sounds like this is very, very frightening, pervasive, and it sounds like we need, I think you might have said, a children's environmental health strategy to address these issues. But clearly you people, like yourself, scientists like yourself, are on the front line doing this research to give some power to that kind of political will, to let them know that these really are serious hazards and that we are really affecting our future generations.
Correct, yeah.
Yep. Well, thank you so much for sharing your perspective with us today.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Dr. Brooks Gump, Associate Professor in Syracuse University's Department of Public Health, Food Studies, and Nutrition. We have to take another short break for the news, but we'll be right back with an inspiring tale of a medical mission of mercy to the Himalayas. So please stay with us. I'm Linda Cohen. This is FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR.